Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting as found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the fourth week of May 2025, we must acknowledge that these are trying times. Tariffs rocking the markets, layoffs, budget cuts, and policy about faces adding to our financial uncertainty, anti-immigrant moves so widespread and seemingly impulsive that American citizens are being swept up in ICE raids, bedrock elements of the Constitution are being challenged by decree. Even in calmer times, we need to be strong to succeed. We need the ability to make tough decisions. But do we need to be jerks about it? Is meanness and hostility required to be a success? Today's article from Esquire explores these questions. Bad Dojo by David Gauvy Herbert is a deep-running piece on the emergence of a $35 million martial arts empire founded by Tiger Shulman. Is Tiger Shulman's martial arts run like a mafia empire? And if so, is that a bad thing? I'll read. You decide. Before we begin, though, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. Former senseis and business partners accuse Tiger Shulman of building his $35 million a year martial arts empire with mafia tactics. But you don't become America's number one karate kingpin without busting a few faces. What? You expect him to apologize? Bad Dojo by David Gauvy Herbert. The New Jersey Convention and Expo Center is nestled among a series of fading industrial parks just off I-95. Most weekends, it's overrun with model train enthusiasts, hot tub salesmen, and fly fishermen. But on a sunny day in December, the cavernous hall's permascent of pretzel grease is cut with a new odor, the tangy smell of cowhide gloves connecting with flesh. For today, Daniel Tiger Shulman, the strip mall karate kingpin of America, is holding his semi-annual Challenge of Champions. Hundreds of kids in headgear, some as young as five, wail on one another as their parents stalk the sidelines, urging them on in a dozen languages. Ringside, scoreboards glow with names like Menendez, Mohammed, Wang, and Galashvili. A far cry from the villainous dojo full of bleach-blonde teens in The Karate Kid, to which this franchise is sometimes compared. In the far corner, away from the kids, grown men uncork body shots that send a shiver all the way down into my testicles. And there, on the sideline, is the man himself. Before I can procrastinate with another trip to the hot dog stand, an instructor takes me by the arm and presents me to Tiger Shulman. After weeks of back and forth, I'm finally meeting him in person, surrounded by muscle-bound lieutenants and former UFC fighters. He considers me with suspicion. "You know more about my company than I do," he says. "It scares me." As we talk, Shulman taps my shoulder and chest, almost like he's range-finding in case he decides to flatten me with a jab-cross combo. Only the steady stream of children provides reassurance as they gather around him, shouting, "Shihan, Shihan," or "Teacher of Teachers," and clamor for selfies. Tiger Shulman's martial arts empire is vast. He has 54 schools across the Northeast where his senseis turn 98-pound weaklings into warriors for a few thousand dollars a pop. The franchise grosses more than $35 million a year, and Shulman himself has made a fortune. At 62, he's still got that intimidating aura, flinty stare, and the 8-pack, too. But most importantly, he's got respect. Shulman has put so many protégés into the octagon that no less than Joe Rogan has toasted his success in the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Mention Tiger Shulman's karate to a millennial from the New York, New Jersey area and witness a blast of nostalgia. Saturday morning cartoons in the 1990s and 2000s were flooded with his ads. Kids intimidate bullies and kick monsters out of bedroom windows. A Tina Turner sound-alike wails, "Whoa, Tiger! Yeah, 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 Tiger!" A pitch man exhorts parents to call 1-800-52-TIGER. But behind the pressed white uniforms and kids' birthday parties, Tiger Shulman's karate was once a wild west of broken bones and bruised egos, fortunes made and reputations squandered, where many of the hits were below the black belt. Shulman invited the wrath of prosecutors and police, aggrieved former senseis and keyboard ninjas who called him a scumbag and scam artist. "It's like they've combined the best of multi-level marketing and the mafia," says Sean Kelly, publisher of UnhappyFranchisee.com. A one-star Yelp review sums up his critic's case. "This is the real-life Cobra Kai." By the time we meet at the Challenge of Champions, Tiger Shulman has already decided that I'm writing a hit piece. "If it's going to be that," he says, "write it without me." But soon the bobbing and weaving switches into rope-a-dope. Shulman can take the hits and counterpunch, too. He has a different story to tell if I will listen, how he forged a culture of discipline, personal growth, and honor, and defended it without apology. "You might even change your whole mind," he says. "I'm going to leave out all the bullshit." There is plenty to boast about. 10 fighters, all homegrown at his schools, that he placed in the UFC. The wayward young cousin he molded into a loving father and successful franchisee. The dozens of school owners, some netting up to $500,000 a year, who lead lives of meaning and purpose. Shulman's induction into the New Jersey Martial Arts Hall of Fame, the 500 instructors, franchisees, and friends who recently raised a glass at the company's 40th birthday party. And those embittered former senseis? The dojo storming and stacks of cardboard boxes filled with litigation? "All those things only made me stronger," Shulman says. To his detractors, he has some advice. "You're responsible for your own life. You're responsible for what happens to you. Stop blaming other people. Stop being a wimp. Stop being a wuss about it." Indeed, you do not build America's preeminent martial arts franchise without breaking a few noses. "I don't have any enemies," he says, although that statement is one-sided. While the bitter feuds are in his rearview mirror, plenty of men still want a piece of him, financially and physically. And Tiger Shulman is ready for them. He's been ready for more than half a century, ever since he learned at 9 years old that raw power is the real currency in this life and everything else follows suit. The origin story is legend, told to prospective students, printed in karate magazines, plastered on the wall of the franchise's New Jersey headquarters. One day, in 1972, Shulman's older brother Ben crawled home from the bus stop after anti-Semitic bullies broke his leg. It had been a long road for the Shulman family to this small house in West Haverstraw, New York. His father, David, grew up in Berlin in the 1930s and fled the Nazis as a boy. His family made it all the way to Shanghai, just in time for the Japanese to lock them in an internment camp. Through a chain-link fence, little David watched the Imperial Army practice karate and then use those skills to rough up Chinese civilians. Seeing martial arts in action made a lasting impression on him. David survived the war and made it to Israel, and then Brooklyn, but a sense of helplessness continued. At their yeshiva, conservative Jewish boys bullied Danny and his brothers. Then on the way home through Borough Park, Italian and Irish kids shouted, "Fucking Jews!" at them. They moved to Rockland County, where more anti-Semites awaited them, and now Ben was laid out with a broken leg. Young Danny watched something in his father snap. "That's it," he declared. "You're learning karate. soon. Soon, Danny's whole extended family was mounting the steps of a rundown dojo, the warlike cries of Kai shaking the walls. Danny Shulman excelled. Martial arts was still a niche sport, and most dojos were side hustles for owners with day jobs. He studied a karate style called Kyokushin, or the ultimate truth, pioneered by a legendary Shihan named Mas Oyama. Oyama later became the inspiration for Ryu in the video game Street Fighter. Shulman, diminutive but feisty, earned the nickname Tiger for his speed, strength, and zodiac sign. David Shulman moved the family again, this time to Quakertown, Pennsylvania, where he used his life savings to buy a motel that they ran as a family business. New town, same anti-Semites. The only other Jewish person was a pharmacist named Cohen with 7 adopted Vietnamese kids. The motel was a rough place. Truck drivers and transients, lots of hourly clients. Guests passed bad checks on the way in and stole TVs on the way out. Danny folded towels, unclogged toilets, and laid panel. Shulman was soon helping out in other ways. When he was 17, his mother shook him awake at 2 a.m. "They're killing your father," she cried. He bounded downstairs to find his father grappling with an armed robber. Shulman kicked the intruder into a wall so hard he shit his pants and then subdued him with a chicken wing arm hold until police arrived. The Shulmans lost nothing but some sleep, the local newspaper concluded. Shulman began responding to perceived slights with violence. After a kid shouted "Jew" in the cafeteria, he slammed the bully's head into a lunchroom table. "That wasn't one of the techniques we learned," says Ron Shulman, his younger brother, with a laugh. Later, when a bus driver wrongly blamed Shulman for misbehaving, he beat the driver so badly that he had to crawl into the school to get help. He was briefly expelled, saw a psychiatrist, and returned to graduate. By then, Shulman was fighting competitively, too, first in point matches and later in full-contact knockdown competitions. At an Alabama tournament, he went up against Wai Hioki, a fellow disciple of Mas Oyama. Shulman had already clocked that Oyama-favored Japanese fighters. He felt the judges at the tournament shared that bias. During the fight, Hioki kicked Shulman in the groin without penalty. "If you do it again," said Shulman, "I'm going to knock you out." When the match resumed, Hioki hit him in the balls again. Shulman uncorked a left hook and knocked him out cold. The judges disqualified him. He left his second-place trophy in the gym and quit Oyama's school for good. Everyone told Shulman there was no money in karate. It was a part-time job at best. His father disagreed. "This is America," he said. "You can do what you want." Shulman opened a small dojo in Quakertown and called it United American Karate, a pointed rebuke of Mas Oyama and the Japanese. He would do it his way. The year 1984 was an auspicious one to open a dojo. The Karate Kid made $91 million at the box office, and suburban kids began pouring into strip mall dojos. A thriving under-18 market suddenly made martial arts a viable business. Shulman teamed up with Gary Hellman, a bouncer, and Sharok Merkar, another disaffected disciple of Mas Oyama. Merkar had fled Iran after the overthrow of the Shah a few years earlier. He was a rough character, but Shulman insists he didn't yet know just how violent and turbulent he could be. Together, they recruited a crew of hungry young martial artists, many of them stuck in dead-end jobs. Steve Holland was a high school dropout and Marine veteran working as a corrections officer at the Rockland County Jail, getting cups of piss thrown on him as he patrolled. He was a brawler and no stranger to waking up under a pool table, just the type of man they were looking for. When Hellman asked if he wanted to become his protege and eventually open a school, Holland turned in his prison badge the next day. Along the East Coast, martial arts schools competed for students and spewed venom, each insisting their form of judo, karate, or taekwondo was superior. everybody hated each other, says Mark Glazier, who owned karate schools in New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania. It was like the old days in Japan. Early on, Shulman and Merkar stormed into a rival dojo that was shit-talking them, stepped onto the mat during a class, a massive fuck you to the sensei, and made an ultimatum. Put up your hands or shut up. The sensei was humiliated. He soon closed down. Karate schools are a straightforward business. Pack the mats with students as many times a day as you can and keep people coming back for higher color belts. Kids are typically about 80% of your customers, and profit margins are high. A successful dojo in the suburbs should have 250 students, and in the city perhaps 100 more. But most black belts make terrible small businessmen. Schools limp along with 50 or 100 students, barely enough to keep the lights on. And in the 1980s, martial arts marketing was abysmal. An advertisement in the yellow pages with an intimidating headshot of the owner and bullet points of the obscure disciplines he'd mastered. Shulman, though, was a natural marketer with a flair for the dramatic. He held live demonstrations at high schools, strip mall parking lots, and theaters before screenings of movies like Bloodsport and Sidekicks. Students spin-kicked cigarettes out of Merkar's mouth and broke boards and blocks. A lot could go wrong. Hellman, a top sensei, once attempted a spinning round kick at a block of ice and instead sliced off a chunk of his heel. It was a punishing way to sell a handful of two-for-one class specials for $9.50, but it worked. The showstopper involved a Louisville slugger. 4 to 6 men would hold a wooden baseball bat steady so that Shulman could split it in half with his shin. Even in success, the trick was excruciating. Busted blood vessels, a massive bruise, and permanent calcium deposits after healing. Shulman's acolytes enthusiastically followed his example, sometimes to painful extremes. At the opening of his own dojo, Steve Curran, an ambitious sensei, tried to break 2 bats at once. Instead, his shin snapped so badly that his foot could touch his knee. He left in an ambulance. As the business grew, Shulman decided that he needed a new name. United American Karate was difficult to trademark. He market-tested Tiger Shulman's Karate. One respondent said it sounded like an aggressive accountant. But the name stuck. Growing a chain of karate schools is all about maintaining a culture of discipline and excellence. Creating one successful dojo is doable. Building a brand, it requires people you trust. Ron Shulman, Danny's athletic and soft-spoken younger brother, enlisted to help him expand the empire. The Shulman brothers and Merkar visited their black belt students' homes and met with parents who were grateful that their wayward sons had finally found a purpose. Tiger's team brought copies of monthly profit statements, sometimes upwards of $15,000 per school. Then they made the pitch. Open your own dojo, an investment that could cost as much as $165,000. Franchisees would later describe the terms as outrageous. Pay a 10% management fee off the top and then own just 49% of the school. These unlicensed franchises were then required to buy gloves, gis, and other apparel at huge markups from Shulman's apparel company, later named Tiger. The owner instructor, meanwhile, got a base salary of just $250 a week. When one young black belt asked to consult an attorney, Shulman belittled and reprimanded him, according to subsequent litigation, and said he had no right to question his mentor and superior. And still, they signed on. Think about it, Merkar tells me. They come in because they don't have self-esteem. You're a nobody outside the school, but when you're inside, your belt means something, and they were getting a lot of girls, and they were getting a lot of parents. Indeed, fraternizing with moms, some single, many married, was a major perk. The sensei had given her kid confidence, maybe even taught a Mother's Day class. Her husband wasn't the man she'd married, and now the sensei was looking at her like a woman for the first time in years. "You know what a badge bunny is?" asked Holland, who owned the Toms River, New Jersey dojo, referring to women who romantically pursue police officers. "We had belt bunnies." They came into Holland's office and locked the door or found him at bars and slipped their hands down his pants. One woman, he says, came to his dojo every morning in nothing but garters and a trench coat. Encounters with the senseis during class weren't uncommon either. "Kids are out on the mat," says Rob Shirey, who skipped joining the army to open a school in Philadelphia, "and they're banging them in their office." Shulman's rivals ran their dojos like regular businesses. "A huge mistake," he says. "In the martial arts world, money flows from power, not the other way around. When it gets down to it, it's can you kick my butt or not?" says Steve Bosick, the franchise's longtime chief operations officer. And no one could intimidate like Shulman. The power translated into profits. By 1991, Shulman was paying himself more than $100,000 a month. The aggression carried over into competitions. When his fighters were down a few points, Shulman directed them to make illegal hits. "So you would go in there and do a jump-spinning back kick and knock him out of the fucking ring, cave in his chest," Holland says. "The referee would deduct a few points for the violation. But guess what? That guy didn't come at me again. And now I could win." At Sony Plaza on Madison Avenue in New York, Holland and his top students broke blocks and performed katas before an official screening of The Next Karate Kid. One pupil had recently been hit by a car and couldn't attend. Hilary Swank autographed a glossy for him, but Pat Morita refused. Holland went apeshit and Morita relented. Even Mr. Miyagi wasn't safe. Sticking it to bullies was Shulman's real passion. Once, when he visited Mark Glazier's dojo in northern New Jersey, he saw a sensei abusing several white belts, the lowest level. He grabbed a gi from Glazier's office and went out onto the mat. "When it came to me, I put a beating on him," Shulman says with a smile. Glazier drove his sensei to the emergency room with cartilage sticking out of his nose. But Shulman knew that if you protect a man, he'll be safe for a day. Teach a man to punch and kick, and he'll be safe for a lifetime. That was the mission. For some senseis, the trade-off of Tiger's martial culture, sex, power, and fraternity in exchange for low pay and draconian rules was too much. "I began to feel that I was a servant or slave of Shulman," wrote an early owner instructor, Shimon Ben Mashia, in subsequent litigation. Although respect is an important element of karate, slavery or involuntary servitude is not an element of martial arts and is against the law and public policy. Ben Mashia told Shulman that he wanted out of his Long Island dojo so that he could join his uncle in the diamond business. Shulman agreed, but Ben Mashia didn't leave the karate world as he'd promised. Instead, according to court filings, he took his school's enrollment list, reassigned himself the valuable 731 kick phone number, and secretly opened two new schools. This betrayal could not stand. "They do things and they think there's no consequences," Bosick says. "They're like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to betray you, I'm going to lie to you." Ron Shulman finishes his thought, "And I'm going to hide behind the law." On the night of August 12, 1991, Shahrokh Merkar walked into United Fitness Center carrying a subpoena. "Shimon Ben Mashia," Merkar shouted, "you've been served." Ben Mashia fled into his office, and Merkar tore at the door handle while children as young as 7 looked on in horror. Shulman was waiting in the parking lot, and the two of them sped away. The lawsuit alleged that Ben Mashia's new dojos violated his non-compete clause. Shulman couldn't resist further humiliating him in court documents. If Shimon, a psycho Shihan, truly believed these men were dangerous, he would not have cowered in his office and left, a brown belt woman and several children alone to defend him. Ben Mashiach soon got a temporary order of protection. He was right to be afraid. Shulman's senseis were furious. He hit Tiger, says Nick Gravina, a loyal foot soldier who opened his first dojo with Shulman at just 19 years old. He hit all of us. On Saturday night, Gravina and his brother Vince drove to Ben Mashiach's Levittown school. They expected it to be empty, but when they peered through the window, they saw Ben Mashiach training with a group of instructors who soon surrounded them in the parking lot. The Gravina brothers went back to back and took on half a dozen senseis. "We smashed them," Gravina tells me. He tried to eye-gouge Shimon's brother, Shagai Ben Mashiach, and 30 years later his palm is still scarred where Shagai bit him. Such was the animosity that after the cops cuffed them all face down in the parking lot, Gravina slurped up oily water from a puddle and spit on Shimon. Tiger Shulman got into the action, too. He recruited two lieutenants, stormed into Ben Mashiach's dojo, and as 20 kids watched from the mat, Shulman closed the office door and went to work. He choked Ben Mashiach, threw punches, headbutts, a right hook, and then a left. He broke Ben Mashiach's nose and left him with a sprained neck. Karate expert is hit with assault charge, read the headline in Newsday's coverage of the turf war. Shulman, 31, exhibited tremendous restraint in the altercation, his attorney told the paper. The loser starts it and the winner gets prosecuted, and it was never more true than in this case. It was another marketing coup. Tiger Shulman was selling self-defense, and the beating coverage was earned media. On the radio, Howard Stern and Robin Quivers joke that they'd rather learn karate from Shulman than the guy left with the fractured nose. It was the best advertisement, Bosick says. The phones were lighting up. Shulman was eventually acquitted. He boasted to Merkar that he'd followed his father's advice. If you fight someone, do it alone, so that it's his word against yours. Shulman pursued Ben Mashiach through the courts for years, even serving Ben Mashiach's students, some as young as 8, with subpoenas for depositions. The litigation borders on a personal vendetta. As Shulman knows, I have no assets and have filed for bankruptcy, Ben Mashiach wrote in court filings. Shulman eventually won a 6-figure judgment. Shulman later heard that Ben Mashiach killed himself, a detail he relates with a shrug. By now, profitable Mick dojos, martial arts franchises with dubious techniques that purists dubbed bullshido, were proliferating, and outsiders wanted a taste. And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to the Bad Dojo. In the mid-1990s, an ambitious young stockbroker named Jordan Belfort, whose story would later be chronicled in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, offered to take Shulman public. But Shulman was all about slow growth. He opened schools not when he found a ripe location, but when one of his black belts was ready to take over. He also had a nose for scoundrels, and he smelled one. He declined. His friend, Mark Glazier, accepted Belfort's offer, and his 4-location franchise went public with the ticker symbol KICK. Belfort soon agreed to leave the securities industry. Master Glazier Karate International foundered, and Shulman scooped up his schools on the cheap. By the mid-1990s, Shulman's karate empire sprawled across 4 states. Keeping senseis motivated and fit and kicking up cash required a firm hand. Every Tuesday, owners arrived at corporate headquarters in Paramus, New Jersey, for an intense morning of sparring, followed by a business meeting. Merkar looked forward to these weekly sessions, which he called the Tuesday beating. During sparring sessions, someone would call switch, and senseis who weren't enrolling enough kids would find themselves facing him. I would give them a little bit of an attitude adjustment, Merkar says with a laugh. It always worked. And then all of a sudden the numbers would come up because they get lazy. Once Merkar knee-kicked a sensei in the face. Wow, he said, your nose is on your cheek. Instructors held down the screaming instructor while Merkar reset his nose. Shulman wielded a wooden sword called a shinai. Arrive late or forget to keep your hands up and you get welts that could last for days. Senseis dubbed the bruises they sustained while sparring Kyokushin tattoos. Instructors limped from the dojo with cracked ribs and torn ACLs. It got to the point where you questioned if you should step out of line again, said Rob Shirey, the Philadelphia school owner. You're dreading going up the following week because you're still in pain from the previous week. The physical fear was matched by a financial anxiety. Because of the draconian contracts they'd signed, they could only sell their stakes for pennies on the dollar. You're not going to get your money back, Merkar told the senseis. If you want to leave, leave. Shulman acknowledges motivating students with a shinai, which was common in karate schools at the time. He adamantly denies punishing underperforming owners, though he can't speak to Merkur's behavior. It's a made-up story to make me look like a tyrant, Shulman says. With regard to buyout prices, Ron Shulman explains that because classes were prepaid, buying into a school was actually a liability because the new owner was agreeing to teach thousands of free classes. Industry sources estimated that Tiger Shulman's karate was now grossing $15 million a year. Shulman bought a house in Upper Saddle River, New Jersey, and installed a home gym, a steam room, and sparring mats. Merkar was making a small fortune, too. His protégés were required to kick up a percentage of their earnings, netting him tens of thousands a month. But in other ways, the two men were headed in opposite directions. Merkar spent freely and dabbled in get-rich-quick schemes and Scientology. When Steve Bosick, the COO, bought a Lexus, Merkar mocked him by dropping brochures from Lamborghini and Ferrari dealerships on his desk. What? Are you only going to drive a Lexus all your life? And he reveled in his power, threatening people at the gym, on vacation, even at home, when a judge asked him about his wife's credible claims that she'd been subjected to hours-long beatings. He denied it, but added sarcastically, "To be honest, what I do for my job, I don't need 2 hours to beat her up." Shulman's sculpted body and fearsome reputation landed him on the cover of Black Belt magazine, but he was a softie at home. He started training his two daughters early on. He'd sneak up during Saturday morning cartoons, put them in a light chokehold, and ask, "How do you get out of this?" He burst into tears when they gave him Father's Day cards. In the mid-1990s, a young cousin, Nissim Levy, was getting into street fights. His family begged Shulman for help, and Levy came to live with him. "Imagine going from Far Rockaway to Upper Saddle River," Levy tells me, still oozing gratitude. He began training with Danny and Ron, worked at the Chelsea School, and later became a franchisee himself. Family was everything in Shulman's world. Shulman loyalists say he and Merkar were total opposites. Shulman was Mufasa to Merkar's Scar, light to his shadow. They squabbled over money. Merkar, meanwhile, began whispering to senseis that Shulman was cheating them. Among the disgruntled was Stephen Holland. When he left, Shulman refused to buy out his share of the Toms River School he'd built into a local powerhouse, a stake he felt was worth roughly $70,000. But Holland wasn't just another nobody. His dad was a somebody, a state senator. In November 1995, the New York Attorney General's office contacted Shulman, all but accusing him of committing franchise fraud. Shulman ignored the first letter, and then the second. Prosecutors began calling in senseis for interviews. Most didn't flip, but a few did. Turn off your recorder, Mercar told the prosecutor. You're going about this all wrong. He then proceeded to make the government's case for them and set off a war. On the night of July 21st, 1997, Ron Shulman and the Gravina brothers arrived at the Hub, a strip mall in West Nyack, New York. Nestled among a pharmacy, a bank, and a grocery store was Thomas Clifford's Karate Academy. Their target, a turncoat named Patrick DaCosta. A year earlier, amid the Attorney General's investigation, DaCosta and three other senseis had failed to show up for a Tuesday meeting. A few hours later, Mike Sachs, the chief financial officer, dropped a 2-inch-thick lawsuit on Shulman's desk. Boom. They were suing the company for fraud and breach of contract. DaCosta had good reason to be upset. The Shulman brothers had all but promised DaCosta a six-figure income if he agreed to pay $165,000 to take over the Spring Valley School. He'd even put up his family's property as collateral. In the end, DaCosta never made more than $35,000 a year. Since leaving, things had been looking up for DaCosta at his new job. Just weeks earlier, the local newspaper profiled him as a beloved local role model. Adults and children say a class taught by DaCosta is something special, wrote the Journal News. Now, those same students watched in horror as Ron Shulman and the Gravina brothers burst into the dojo wearing black gis. "I'm going to fuck you in the ass and break every bone in your body," shouted Vince Gravina. He elbowed the school owner, Thomas Clifford, and then Ron Shulman issued a warning to DaCosta. "This is not over," he said. "I'll take care of you. I'm going to kill you." When Clarkstown police arrived, Clifford was shaken. Tiger Shulman, he told officers, was afraid of his expanding karate chain. He worried the turf war would escalate. The Shulman brothers were a throwback to feudal Japan, DaCosta told the Wall Street Journal. Shulman had been deeply stung by their betrayal. "When you do great things for people, you don't expect they're going to turn on you," Shulman says. Now these traitors would feel his pain. Shirey, another sensei-turned-plaintiff, arrived at the Orange County Courthouse for a hearing, but Shulman was a no-show. As Shirey exited the courthouse, 15 black belts surrounded him and his wife, and Ron Shulman punched him in the head. Ron was convicted of second-degree harassment and paid a $100 fine. Someone also kicked down the front door of the home where he lived with his wife and young daughter. "It was just a nightmare," Shirey says. Shulman's karate empire was under siege. In New York, a state judge now barred him from opening new schools and ordered him to stop his heavy-handed intimidation tactics. In December 1996, the Pennsylvania Attorney General sued too, accusing the karate chain of violating the Commonwealth's Health Club Act. Even parents were upset. Mercar had developed an aggressive upsell strategy in which, after her son took a few dozen classes of a 150-session pack, the instructor encouraged mom to buy an additional black belt package of 350 classes. The New York Attorney General dubbed the sales technique a bait-and-switch. Parents staged protests outside schools and claimed they were being stiffed on refunds. "Basically, it's the feeling of a cult," one parent told the Philadelphia Inquirer. Shulman looks at you and says, "Have I ever steered you wrong?" And yet, still they came. The product on offer. Join a martial brotherhood where you lost weight, kicked ass, and maybe got laid, was too good. To this day, even Shulman's most vicious critics have total admiration for the training program he developed. In 1997, Elliot Spiegel was volunteering at the 4th of July parade at Paramus when he saw a contingent from the local Tiger Shulman dojo. Spiegel was a heavy guy at 5'8" and 330 pounds, but the idea of getting stronger intrigued him. At his free trial class, he met Sensei Vince Gravina, who struck him as an uber-alpha male, he says. The mold was made from that guy. Apex predator number one, he thought. I want to be like that. Spiegel started training 2 days a week, then five, then weekends too. Was he committed? Oh, yeah, says his wife, Fran Spiegel, with a laugh. He was all in. At home, he shouted at his 4-year-old son, make a choice, be the hammer or be the nail. Spiegel earned a black belt, quit his sales job, and began working under his sensei for $25,000 a year. He wasn't anyone's image of a karate guy. He was so big that he couldn't fit into even an extra-large karate outfit. Instead, he wore white sweatpants around the dojo. But Spiegel knew how to sell, and it set him apart. Gravina, he says, wanted to keep a smart Jew like him around. Spiegel was dedicated. Shulman's top sensei had it all, luxury cars, adoring students, and for some, body counts off the charts. A man once came into the dojo with tears in his eyes, begging an instructor to stop sleeping with his ex-wife. It was the Flint, Michigan of toxic masculinity, Spiegel says today. Still, he dreamed of opening his own school. But while he'd gotten strong enough to break cement blocks, he hadn't lost much weight. Shulman wouldn't let him attend trade shows, Spiegel says, because he was embarrassed by his size. Spiegel finally tried a Shulman-endorsed nutraceutical plan and lost 50 pounds. He was elated. He agreed to be photographed shirtless for a before and after ad campaign. In December 2001, Spiegel arrived at the big Challenge of Champions tournament. He stopped dead in his tracks. There was his meaty torso on a massive poster, all right, but he was just the before photo. I'm the fat skin that the ripped guy is walking out of, he says. All around him, hundreds of kids carried postcard-sized versions of the ad. Other instructors howled with laughter. Spiegel was humiliated. Shulman soon had him fired for insubordination, but Spiegel knew the truth. I was a fat guy able to sell his program, he says. It made him crazy. Shulman initially denied the allegations, but today he's unapologetic. He's selling fitness, he's selling discipline, and he's 350 pounds. It doesn't make any sense. Spiegel was heartbroken. I mourned, he says. My whole life was in and around karate for years. It was like putting me on a horse with one bladder of water and sending me into the desert kind of thing. And he was angry. I wanted his heart on a platter, he says. Spiegel sued. The New York tabloids feasted with headlines like "Too Taekwondo-y" and "Chop Suing Karate King in Fat Spat." As the litigation dragged on, Spiegel's sensei called. I'm scared for you, Elliot, he said. Spiegel felt it was a threat from Shulman. Sensei, you know who I know, Spiegel replied. He has kids. There's nothing scarier than someone who's got nothing left to lose. So tell him to be mindful of what he says and who he sends next. Spiegel tells me. He was referring to a friend named Mel, his ex-girlfriend's tough uncle. Shulman denies making any threats and then laughs. I mean, yeah, he really knows some Jewish gangsters from New York, he says. Ridiculous stuff. But when you're Tiger Shulman and you have a winner's attitude and an attorney with a stuffed piranha in his office, good things can happen. A judge threw out Spiegel's case. Shulman settled Shirey's lawsuit for a nuisance fee. He paid a $185,000 settlement to the New York State, plus $36,000 in refunds to unhappy students. The state can beat anyone, Shulman tells me of the settlement. The state is a mafia. He beat the Pennsylvania Attorney General on appeal, and after he buried Mayor Carr under a mountain of expensive litigation, his partner-turned-arch-rival signed a legal truce. Shulman officially registered the business as a franchise, took a 16.5% fee, and put the past behind him. As the clouds parted, he was already deep into his newest project. On November 12, 1993, Cheesy Graphics and Synth Music introduced the first-ever Ultimate Fighting Championship. The format was revolutionary, all styles welcome, no holds barred, with bans only on eye gouging and biting. In the debut match, Gerard Gourdeau, a 215-pound kickboxer, faced off against Tila Tuli, a 410-pound sumo wrestler. Gourdeau quickly landed the kick heard round the world, knocking out three of Tuli's teeth, and a billion-dollar industry was born. For martial artists, the UFC was a painful reality check that their personal style, which they'd studied for years and stormed into rival dojos to defend, might not actually be the best. For karate diehards, the moment of truth came at UFC 2 in March 1994, when they watched Fred Edish, a fifth-degree black belt, emerge from the tunnel in his gi. "I have absolute faith in my system of Kenpo," he announced before the fight. Kickboxer Johnny Rhodes proceeded to knock out Edish's mouthpiece, flatten him on his back, and stalk him around the octagon as he sprayed blood on the canvas before finally choking him out. "What is our purpose?" Shulman asked his brother as the martial arts world took stock. It was, they knew, to help kids defend themselves in street fights. They needed to innovate. The Shulman brothers traveled to Las Vegas to train with John Lewis, a legendary jiu-jitsu black belt, and slowly evolved their karate curriculum into a mixed martial arts hybrid of kickboxing on your feet and grappling on the ground. Shulman soon created a fight team and packed arenas with hundreds of students, families, and fans who intimidated opponents by chanting in unison, "TSK, TSK," and he was just as combative as ever. In 2002, at the Grappler's Quest tournament in Bayonne, New Jersey, a judge disqualified one of Shulman's fighters for an infraction. After a heated argument, he shouted, "We are done." TSK students refused to fight. Shulman berated the promoter into issuing refunds on the spot, and they all filed out, never to return. As the UFC produced a stream of stomach-churning injuries, snapped forearms, exploding cauliflower ears, bones shooting from kneecaps, along with big pay-per-view revenue, a funny thing happened. The temperature cooled in martial arts, because no doubt remained about the dominance of this hybrid style of striking and grappling. There was no need for puffery and posturing. The dojo wars were over. Shulman launched a full makeover of his business. He changed the franchise name to Tiger Shulman's Martial Arts, and he installed cameras to monitor bad behavior and joined Safe Sport, a nonprofit that polices sexual abuse in amateur sports. Ron Shulman fired senseis who were too flirtatious and instituted a new policy for dating adult students. You had to commit to 6 months minimum to show you were serious. I chuckle about the horny old days to Jimmy Rivera, a Shulman sensei and one-time UFC bantamweight who has competed in bare-knuckle fighting. "You're laughing," he says, sounding like he wants to reach through the phone and box my ears, "but I don't think it's funny. The world has changed, and so has the franchise. Today, the average Tiger Shulman school feels more like a luxury health club than the testosterone-fueled, shouting and bowing dojo of yesteryear. We're much better at it," Shulman says of his ability to spot troublemakers. "We wouldn't have a Sharok Merkar now." Shulman and his crew have softened a little in middle age. They massage tender knees and shoulders, worry about college tuition and elderly parents, and dote on their kids. Even the haters have calmed down. After he was drop-kicked from the karate world, Spiegel became a yoga instructor and life coach. Whenever he thinks about appealing his weight discrimination case against Shulman, he hears his yoga self ask, "Is it worth carrying that anchor around?" There are exceptions. Merkar struggled to forgive and forget, he says, as he watched Shulman grow his empire with impunity. Merkar himself felt swindled out of millions. He was furious and tempted to do something about it. He knew Shulman's daily schedule and home address. "One of the reasons I moved to Vietnam is because I was afraid that I might do something," he tells me. "Get a gun and shoot Shulman." I relayed this threat to Shulman in Sarasota, Florida, during an interview across the bay from his luxury condo, as he's halfway through a Ritz-Carlton cheeseburger. He laughs. I learned this in life, he says. Someone who's really going to do something, he doesn't say anything. Don't be fooled by the powerful shoulders and the unlined face. I've been on the earth for a long time now, Shulman says. At 62, he knows age isn't just a number. It's old, believe me, it's old. Like his senior lieutenants, Shulman insists he's mellowed out too. He watched his daughter Danielle date a series of not-so-good guys, but he restrained himself, said nothing, let her make her own decisions. He cried during the vows at her beach wedding when she finally married Mr. Wright. Shulman has arthritis and sciatica, but that night he danced the hora with abandon. And yet there is a saying about a tiger and his stripes. And yet, on the night of January 1st, 2021, Shulman was in Key West with his second wife, Kim, two daughters, Sister Ruth, and others. They ate dinner on Duval Street, a lively stretch of bars and restaurants. At 10:30 p.m., mounted police began enforcing a curfew. They had bullhorns. They were aggressive. It had been a difficult year for the Shulman family. David, the patriarch, started 2020 in a nursing home. Danny and Ron visited him daily. When COVID hit that spring, he contracted the virus and went on a ventilator. David Shulman had survived the Gestapo in Berlin and the Japanese Imperial Army in Shanghai, slept between jobs in Central Park, and fended off armed robbers in small-town Pennsylvania. But he died alone in a hospital bed, saying goodbye to his four children on a telephone held by a faceless nurse covered in PPE. And then, walking on the sidewalk, pandemic curfew in force, Shulman says police officers began pushing his daughters. He told Ariel, his youngest, to start filming. An officer grabbed her arms and threw her to the ground. Shulman snapped. He pushed a cop, and another tackled him onto the ground. Shulman lay on his back in a classic jiu-jitsu guard position, kicking and kneeing with fury as four cops dogpiled him. In his mugshot, Shulman stares off into space, already over it. His plea deal included an online anger management course. It was very good, he says. I'm not sorry I took it. It was very psychological, and it taught you some things. Does he remember any specific tools for controlling his temper? No, Shulman says. He smiles. His eyes dance with delight. Nothing. And that concludes Bad Dojo by David Gauvey Herbert. And now with the time that we have left, we will look again at learning, although this time it won't be from an anger management course. What I've Learned with Edward Burns, actor, writer, director, producer, 57, New York City. The interview by Michael Sebastian. My dad would say to me, "You're not the most talented, but you are the most tireless." I was a basketball junkie as a kid. I had to outwork everybody because I wasn't the fastest, I wasn't the tallest, I wasn't the strongest. My dad only listened to classical music, which was an odd choice for a New York City cop. He gave me Catcher in the Rye, and I was blown away. I can picture myself sitting on my bed thinking, "Holy shit, they're allowed to say this in a book?" My mom introduced me to the arts. For my birthday, she took me to see Brighton Beach Memoirs on Broadway. I just fell in love, but never thought that would be something available to me as a career. In between school and my first job, I spent a summer living in my car out in the Hamptons. Of course, On the Road was the book I was reading that summer. I was 23 when I wrote The Brothers McMullen. It was in reaction to never seeing characters on film that sounded like the guys and girls I was hanging out with. After my kids were born, my wife, Christy Turlington, and I decided we never wanted to leave New York. Could never even imagine living anywhere else. Christy and I prioritized the kids and our marriage over all the other stuff, and we're lucky because we both find each other funny. And that makes life easier if you're laughing. I went all in on parenting. I coached soccer, basketball, baseball. This time last year, I was coaching my last AAU basketball tournament. I am probably guilty of being a little old school. I'm a kid of the 70s, so I was only familiar with coaches screaming and yelling. I tried to make my screaming and yelling positive as opposed to negative. My wife and I just became empty nesters. It goes by so fucking quickly, you can't believe it. My son turned 19 yesterday, and my wife and I are just like, it flew by. It flew by. I walked away from the Catholic Church. I just stopped going to Mass a long time ago. I still have some faith and some belief, but my definitions of who or what God is are vaguer than they were as a young Catholic. Years ago, I was lucky enough to meet and work with William Kennedy, who wrote Ironweed. I was a young guy at the time and was asking him about his process. He said he wrote every day, even on Christmas. He would make sure he just got a sentence down. I'm not successful every day, but that is what I try to do. I try to write every day. The most terrifying part of being an artist in your 50s? No longer having an audience. If you can't find an audience and turn a profit, you don't get to make another film. It's almost like being put out to pasture by the apathetic public. Regrets? My career choices after Saving Private Ryan, I was overly cautious about trying to make the right next step. Actually, those aren't regrets. Had I made different choices, I would not have met Christy and I would not have my children. I wouldn't trade any of that for an opportunity to have been in X, Y, or Z movie. Yep, the drummer is drumming. Another hour has flown by here on Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit. I have enjoyed reading for you, and I look forward to reading for you again next week. I thought that was a good note to end on. No regrets. No regrets. I hope you've enjoyed these articles. I personally, I felt some compassion for our bad dojo master around his family circumstances and the flight from the Nazis and the Japanese during the war. Although things got pretty rough and tumble and hard to justify some of that business. Anyway, you decide for yourself, and between now and next week, take care of yourself. Stick up for yourself. Try not to get in any fights, if you can. Peace.